Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I am continuing my effort to bring back people who have been on years ago that I have neglected to invite back. My guest today is one of those people, Anthony Johnston. Anthony, thank you for joining me again.
Thank you, Scott. It is lovely to be back after 4 years.
Which is
kind of incredible.
Yes, a lot has happened in those last 4 years.
You could say that, yes.
Yes.
Good Lord, it's been a while.
It has been a while, but I'm glad to have you back. Before we jump into all things Star Trek, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself, Anthony?
Sure. I'm Anthony Johnston. I am a writer of many different things these days. One thing that's happened since the last time I was on, I am best known as the creator of Atomic Blonde, the movie starring Charlize Theron that came out nearly 2 years ago now, which was based on one of my books. And I also write video games and novels and screenplays and all manner of goblinry.
Goblinry?
I record podcasts occasionally as well, yes.
Yes. I'm excited to have you back. And if people listening haven't read or seen any of Anthony's work, what's wrong with you? Go do some of it right now. Well, not right now.
Listen to the episode first.
Yes. And then go and do that. Or if you're multitasking, you can buy some of his stuff while you're listening. All right. So let's talk about Star Trek. Ooh, Star Trek. So when last year we talked about Star Trek, obviously, because that's what this podcast is about, we're going to be talking about an original series episode, which is, I'll tell the episode that we're talking about, Miri, which is first season, episode 11, but depending on what streaming service, it may not be 11, so just look for Miri. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the original series.
I did a Deep Space Nine episode last time I was on, and it was from like season three or something as well. So I hadn't got a clue what was going on. Original series, I'm a bit more aware of and sort of cognizant of, just because, you know, it's the one I grew up watching, like so many people, and it's the one that's obviously been around in the culture for so much longer and has, frankly, so many fewer episodes than any other Star Trek. However, here's a funny thing. I didn't remember this one.
Oh.
I was looking at it going, I don't think I've ever seen this. How can that be? And it turns out that this episode was only ever shown once in the UK.
Really?
And because of its subject matter, it apparently attracted complaints to the BBC, who then withdrew this and a couple of other episodes from the original series, and they were never shown in the UK again until like the 2000s.
That is so wacky.
When I was growing up, this episode was simply Star Trek, you know, was not repeated. I said this before in the previous episode I was on, it was not repeated in the UK as often as it was repeated in the US, you know, in those times before we had things like Next Generation. But it was repeated, you know, once every couple of years or something, they would roll out Star Trek and show it over again. And this episode, along with a couple of others, apparently, was just never shown because the subject matter was considered to be too distressing.
Well, I shouldn't laugh. It is, I guess, slightly distressing, but it just seems...
It's incredible, isn't it?
it is. I mean, I was mostly distressed less by the, the grown-ups getting the disease and more with Captain Kirk and this pre-adolescent girl.
Yes, we'll get to that, I'm sure.
I'm not sure if that was the reason that they didn't show it on
the BBC. No, it wasn't. The complaints were all apparently because it was distressing and about the sort of, because it addresses subjects like madness and, sort of a world without adults and stuff like that and kids doing terrible things.
Oh, man.
It's crazy. So the point being that I was coming to this episode completely new, even though it's original series. I had never seen it before.
When I watched the original series episodes, and we were talking about this before we started recording, they're longer than most other Star Trek episodes because of less commercial breaks, as you pointed out. And it feels to me like they can cut out. There's a lot of Doctor Who gets this, old Doctor Who also has this, a lot of like walking in corridors, and you're like, well, I don't need to see all of this. I get a little bored with the pacing sometimes. In this episode, I did not feel that way, because even though they did show people just walking around, they also had, as they were walking around on this planet, you could hear in the background creepy children chanting things and things.
Right, so there's tension even to the corridor scenes.
Exactly.
Yeah, to the exploration scenes. I agree. In fact, there's a point in this, not long after it starts, when they get down to the planet and they get attacked by the guy who, you know, we later learn is dying of this terrible disease. Mm-hmm. And Kirk almost immediately concludes he's an adult, but with the mind of a child. And you think, like, hang on a minute, you've got no evidence for that. There's nothing in his manner that really confirms that. Sure, suggests it, but nothing that confirms it. But, and I know this, obviously, as somebody who writes stories myself, sometimes you don't want to dwell on something where the detail is not important. Mm-hmm. And clearly, because they had so much to get into this episode, that was one area where the discovery of that detail was deemed just unimportant. Like, that's not how they figure that out, is not important to the plot. So let's just have him say it. He happens to be right. Well, hey, let's, you know, now carry on and get on with the story. Sometimes you have to do that if you're trying to get a lot in, or even if you're not, you know, even when you're writing something like a novel, there are certain things where you think, I could spend pages and pages, or in the case of, you know, a screenplay, obviously 10 minutes or whatever, with people figuring out why this is the case, or coming to a realization. But really, does it matter? Is how they do that important? Not really. You know, it's not as interesting as the rest of it. So you just, have somebody make a leap of intuition, a quantum leap of understanding, and then you can move on with the rest of the story. And that doesn't happen a lot in series from this time, because they are so much slower. As you said, the pacing is so much slower in this Doctor Who, even, you know, cop series. You watch things like Streets of San Francisco and stuff. They're so slow moving compared to modern shows. We're much more narratively literate these days, and especially with visual narrative like movies and TV and even comic books. So you don't have to hold the audience's hand as much.
I wanted to talk to you about this, not that particular scene, but this particular subject, because I know you are a writer, and I know that storytelling, as you said, has changed dramatically in the 50 years since this was on TV. More than 50 years now, I think.
Is it really 50 years?
Yeah, it's craziness. And so, and I'm often struck by how I can still enjoy, not that, you know, I've read novels that are hundreds of years old, so, and plays, obviously, Shakespeare, people still enjoy it, but the original series, like if you watch other shows on the time 50 years ago, I don't think that you can enjoy them as much as something as timeless as the original series. That could be my own bias, because I am a giant Star Trek fan. But
well, I think there's a certain amount of bias, sure. But also, I mean, one of the things that I really like about the original series is, I mean, it is, yes, it's cheesy and old and, you know, slow at times and all that. But the reason that I enjoy watching the original series is because it is like theater. It's like watching televised theater. You know, the sets are so bare bones. The locations are equally bare bones, you know, or reused sets like this one. This is the Andy Griffith Show, I think this was, I read that this was reused from. And so the focus has to be on the concept, the execution of the concept, and the characters. And the original series of Star Trek in particular is almost defiantly about the three main characters. You know, there's that old saw about them three being three aspects of the same personality, which is, you know, I suppose that is true to an extent, but it is so much about those three characters and the relationship between them. And they're so well performed, thank goodness. That's what I enjoy watching about the original series. And I think that's why so many people come back to the original series. You know, yes, it's cheap and cheesy, and some of the plots are not very good and what have you, but it doesn't matter, because what you're watching is great actors playing great characters in interesting circumstances. And, you know, there's not a lot more you can ask for beyond that in a dramatized show.
That is exactly right. And that, And this people actually are staging original series episodes as stage plays. There's someone in, I forget, not someone, a group in maybe Seattle that does Trek in the Park, much like Shakespeare in the Park, where they stage original series episodes in the park as a theater thing.
That's amazing. Oh, I'd love to see one of those. That's fantastic. God, can you imagine them doing Devil in the Dark?
I think they might have done that, actually.
Fantastic.
Now, before we move on to talking about the actual episode, I want to talk about the people, the actors who are in this episode, because, and not a particular actor, but as I was watching it, and there's no really nice way for me to say this, but there are a lot of interesting-looking people in this episode. And I was struck by the fact that if they were making this show now, I wonder if the same types of people, like these don't look like people you would see on a modern day television show. And I'm not saying that they're ugly people. I'm just saying that they are not.
No, they're normal looking
people. Exactly. They're like regular people. It's like if I showed up in a Star Trek episode, you would think he's not a normal television face.
Or any of us. People start looking in the credits going, is he famous for something else? Is it stunt casting? Yeah, TV these days is unbearably full of beautiful people. Even, mm-hmm. I mean, famously Game of Thrones being a great example of, you know, Peter Dinklage, the character he plays, Tyrion, in the books, literally has no nose, you know, and he's hideously scarred. And in the book, they gave him like, you know, a small scar across his nose. And that's about your lot.
That I will stop now casting judgments on their appearance. And once again, I should be clear that I did not find them unattractive. It was just they're not TV beautiful people.
Sulu is not in this one either, is
it? Nor is Scotty.
You're right. Yeah.
It's just, so let's talk about this episode. And one of the other things I want to talk about. So you talked about how, with kind of, you know, narrative shortcuts, Kirk figures out kind of it could have been the mystery of this episode, but it wasn't. It's just like he figures it out and now it's the problem, not the mystery, right? The other thing they do in this episode is they find this planet, they come across this planet that is apparently, it's very far away from Earth, but it's an exact duplicate of Earth.
Yep. They're all remarkably blasé about.
Yes. And I feel like, you know, they beam down and they found out a whole, but you know, that there's this disease and there are children that are really old, and we'll get to it. But they all, I feel like the bigger mystery is, why is this planet exactly like Earth?
Right. Why does it have the same continents and everything? Yeah. It's one thing to be an M-class planet. It's quite another to literally have the Americas.
Yes. And nobody seems too concerned. They're like, oh, all right. Well,
yeah, they just go, oh, it's another Earth, whatever.
And it has no particular bearing on the plot whatsoever either. So,
no, it's so strange. I wonder if maybe they just didn't have the budget for, you know, a sort of painting of a different planet. So they're like, oh, I'll just use a picture of the Earth. It'll be fine.
No, it'll care. They'll forget about it as soon as they get on the planet.
Although they had the budget to give, you know, although actually, no, I was going to say about Yeoman Rand's crazy quilted hairdo, but she has that in several episodes, doesn't she? So, you know, with that weird sort of lattice work wig.
Oh, man. And so, yes, So you said, Anthony, at the beginning that this Star Trek is groundbreaking in many ways, and it is true, certainly in sexual politics and feminism. So Yeoman Rand is with the landing party as they go down to, you know, check out what's happening on this planet, because there is an Earth-style distress signal that brought them here. Once again, they don't explain why this is a particularly Earth-style distress signal, and they don't really seem to care. They just leave at the end of the episode, but whatever, doesn't matter. So they bring Yeoman Rand down to this planet. Everybody has a phaser, I noticed, except for Yeoman Rand.
Oh, does she? I confess I didn't notice that. Yeah, I did notice how she was the one sent to comfort, you know, crying children and all that stuff. Sort of thing, yeah, which is,
And she, you know, they're putting her in the same amount of danger as everybody else, so I don't understand why they wouldn't just give her a phaser, but they don't. So maybe she's not rated for phasers, or she's not trained on them. But anyway, so they beam down to the Andy Griffith Show set that has been beaten up, and it's like, you know, clearly something bad has happened. It's degraded over time, and there's a bunch of crap all over the place. And in a very strange scene, which I think they just did and this is the scene you're talking about, where they come across this tricycle that's broken. And the thing that I thought was strange is Captain Kirk points out the tricycle to Spock for some reason.
Yeah, I didn't get that either. I'm like, do tricycles not exist in the 25th century? And then he just hands it to Bones. It's like, what
is going on with this tricycle? I did not get it. But then, so Bones is looking at the tricycle and he gets attacked by this disfigured, well, we don't know if he's disfigured, right? He could just be an alien at this point. Man, who is very unhappy. They wrestle around with him for a bit. Captain Kirk, who cannot resist punching people, punches him instead of shooting him with his phaser on stun, which actually we find out was a good decision because later on he does that to somebody else, inflicting, and he kills them by accident. Yeah, so good he didn't do it this time. And then they talk to him for a bit, and he's upset about the broken tricycle. And this is when Captain Kirk makes the astounding leap of logic Antony described earlier, where it's like, oh, it's a, an adult body, but a mind of a child, and he has a disease of some sort.
An interesting sort of production thing in that scene as well is some of the cuts are really bad. Like the final punch doesn't sync at all with the actions of the close-up, and then they cut to a wide where the guy falls over, and they're not synchronized at all. And also, at one point, you can see, I think it's DeForest Kelly's stunt double, like trying not to, you know, show his face to the camera, very deliberately facing away from the camera before they cut, and there suddenly is Bones in the background, and it's DeForest Kelly, and you can see him. But at no point do you actually see the actor turn. He's just suddenly, he's, one minute he's facing away, the next he's facing the camera.
Well, you know, you do what you got to do, and I do wonder if that's more noticeable because, you know, they did remaster these.
Oh, the restores, that's true, actually, which are beautiful, aren't they?
They are. It's a lucky for us that they shot this all on film, and so that they could restore it so beautifully.
Oh, is that why it looks so good? Right.
And they also redid the special effects, so the planet...
Did they?
Yep. Well... Okay. They did. The planet looked much worse orbiting it.
See, like I said, this is the first time I've seen it, so I didn't. I had no idea.
Now, I'm assuming you may not have seen the remaster, but you probably did if you watched it on streaming.
I did. Okay. The one I saw was, you can tell the remasters, because I've watched them before, I thought I'd watched them all before, but you can tell the remasters, if nothing else, because of the vibrancy of the colors, the uniforms are all beautiful, yes, vibrant colors, which they are not in the original broadcast.
That is true. And then a fun fact, so CBS, I don't know how fun this is, but CBS spent a bunch of money to remaster all the original series, which is a great decision. They replaced the special effects of, you know, the Enterprise when it's orbiting planets and stuff. And this is one of the first episodes they did. Turns out the model, their computer model of the Enterprise was wrong. And so they're in this episode, so they quickly had to fix it because I don't know if you know this about super fans of particular things, Antony, but they are very attentive to detail. So
if, really? Yes, I hadn't heard.
It's true. I know you being someone who creates things on the internet may not be aware of this.
Oh, yes. But... No, we don't have that problem in comics or video games at all. No.
So if you get even a tiny thing wrong, people tend to get upset. So, they had to fix it and replace the model that they had before with the corrected model for this episode, which I thought was funny. But, yes, good job remastering. So they're on the planet. We know that something bad is happening with this guy. And then, you know, Captain Kirk punches him a couple times. They wrestle him to the ground. Then he dies, and Bones says he's dead, but he doesn't say he's dead, Jim, which was sad. I was hoping he would say he's dead, Jim. And then they find, so they're looking around the planet, and they come across Miri hiding in a closet. She's a young girl who's terrified of them for some reason. It takes them a really long time. Well, it felt like a really long time to figure out what grups meant when she keeps saying grups are crazy and, you know, do bad things, and they're like, what's a grup? I don't know. And then Yeoman Rand finally says, oh, grown-ups. Yes, that's right.
I did like that they gave that realization to Rand. That is at least, you know, that in itself is something for the 1960s.
Yes, I did appreciate that, but I did think she probably could have figured it out a little sooner. But
well, they all could have, frankly.
Well, it's true. It's not that hard. So she basically says, you know, and meanwhile, the the two security guards who apparently are Galloway and Fields, and I only know that because I'm looking at the Memory Alpha article, are with Spock, and they're looking around, and Spock, and they get hit with some rocks. And this is one of those shots that I would have found boring in a similar situation, because they're basically just walking around the set looking at stuff. But they intercut it with children's taunting them and chanting in kind of an ephemeral way. Like, you don't know where they are. They're hiding because the kids know this place, and they are afraid of grownups. So they're like throwing rocks at them and chanting, and it's all creepy. So
it's basically classic sort of horror movie staging, mm-hmm. At that point, which, you know, was interesting. I don't know whether, because this is season one, so I don't know whether they'd done anything like that with that same kind of spooky tension up until this point in the series, but it works, absolutely. To the point where, because I tried not to read too much about this before watching it, because I knew I was watching it for the first time, but I did read that thing about it not being broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was like, how come I haven't seen this? And because that mentioned that one of the complaints was that it deals with issues of madness, I actually thought for a moment that maybe they were going mad and that they were hearing the voices, you know, that mm-hmm. there were nobody, there was nobody else on the planet, and they weren't being taunted, but they imagined that they were. I'm not necessarily saying that would have been more interesting, but that's a success again of the storytelling, because the way it was staged, you couldn't actually tell, like, are they imagining this or is it real?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was very effective. One thing that did amuse me, however, was Spock's three steps up a gantry and then immediately leap off, rather than just stepping back down. He does a dramatic leap off over the railing.
Well, he has to run after the noise he heard, because these children are very effective hiders. So he's like,
Right, but I'm pretty sure that it would have actually been quicker if speed was his concern to just launch off of the steps and go back down the way he came. But
you know, sometimes Spock has to have a little fun, you know?
Right, even Spock has to get physical sometimes, yeah.
Exactly. And so they
actually, what am I saying? In the original series, he was quite physical, yeah. Wasn't he? Like smashing computers mm-hmm. in the mock time and things like that. So,
that's right. You don't want to get in his way when he is in
Ponfar, yeah.
Yes. And so we find out from Miri that there is this disease that affects grown-ups, and they're all dead, and there are a bunch of kids hanging around. And this is when Captain Kirk looks at his hand and, he's got a blue thing on his hand, which is...
I think before then is when they get introduced and we get the creepy Kirk moment.
Oh, where, yes.
Mm-hmm. Where he says, that's a pretty name for a pretty young woman. My first thought was, yes, pretty young being the operative words here, Captain.
Captain Kirk, I will say, and William Shatner, very charming, right? And so... in most circumstances, I do not find it uncomfortable because he's being charming and it's fine. In this circumstance, she is, I guess, just on the cusp of puberty.
Right, she's not even gone through puberty yet. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the point, is that she's prepubescent. Now, she's played by an actress who's much older. I did read that she was actually played by an actress who was in her late teens, and that's why she wears that shapeless smock. Costume was to hide the fact that actually, you know, underneath it, she had a grown woman's body.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, she is supposed to be prepubescent. This is not a good look.
No, I think I will assume that they were trying to go for Captain Kirk. It's clear that they want Captain Kirk to be comforting to her, but I think they overshot it and it turns into creepy.
I agree. So let's speak no more of it and move on.
It's done. Luckily, nothing happens. It's just a little creepy. But and then, Captain Kirk, Miri and Captain Kirk have a conversation. And Miri, I think, actually finds the splotch on Captain Kirk's hand, which basically proves her point that, you know, you're going to have this disease and kill everybody. So I shouldn't get too attached to you.
Right, because you might go mad and kill me, yeah.
Exactly. But luckily, So I have a lot of questions about this planet that is exactly like Earth. It seems like they have beamed down to a little town that also seems to just so happen to be the center of where they were doing research on this plague that was going around.
Well, to be fair, they followed the signal.
That's true. That is true.
They followed the distress signal. So it's not much of a leap to the idea that the distress signal, which has been automated for the last three centuries, would also have come from the R&D center. Well, R&D is not the, not the right word, but you know what I mean, from the research center, mm-hmm. where they were looking into the disease. So that part of it, I think you can look beyond coincidence for that.
Yes, no, and this could be like some kind of like satellite CDC office or something, Center for Disease Control. So that's okay. And obviously to your earlier point about, you know, as a storyteller, you kind of need to get people and in locations where it makes sense. So it's
is them finding the research center, you know, is that an interesting thing to include in the plot? Not really. Let's just have them go there. I was more concerned, to be honest, by the fact that they outright state that this happened 300 years ago. And that's why these kids are, you know, these kids are advanced. What is it? They advance 1 month every year or something like that. And my thought was, regardless of that, so these kids have literally been alive for 300 plus years, mm-hmm. and yet they still behave like children. They haven't figured out what radios are. They haven't figured out what phones are. They haven't built anything. They haven't learned to build anything. I had more of a problem with that. And I understand why necessary for the story, but they placed such emphasis on the sheer length of time that these kids have been on their own down here. It drew too much attention, I felt, to questions of, well, if they've been here that long, have they not learned anything? Have they literally just been playing cowboys and Indians for 300 years?
Yeah, we meet so there's a whole bunch of kids that we meet. That's a group of kids. And they are, much to your point, Anthony, they're like super childish, which is, and I only say that because, to your point, they've been there for 300 years. So I feel like they would have at least gotten bored of the silly games that they're playing and maybe investigated other things.
You'd think, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Because they seem to enjoy playing like school, which children do, but like for 300 years? I feel like they would do other things and perhaps not just chant bonk, bonk on your head.
Although that was quite, you know, it was quite effective when all the kids are chanting that, you're like, okay, that is quite creepy, actually.
It was creepy, I wasn't, but I did have that same thought. I was like, I know that they are kids, but I have met some kids in my life, and while they do the kinds of things that we see in the show, they also are capable of other things, and given 300 years, I think they would probably think, hey, maybe we should think about like where our food comes from, which apparently they don't.
That was the other coincidence, was that they arrive on the planet, just happens to be a couple of months before all the kids' food is about to run out. Mm-hmm. That was a bit of a weird coincidence. it's, you know, emotional maturity is not entirely tied to physical maturity. You know, yes, the brain changes as you age and all that, and physical maturity is a factor. But it's not the only factor. And I think even in the 1960s, I'm pretty sure we knew that just from life.
Right. I think that they're just playing up the childish aspect of the children to make it creepier, I think, and to show that,
course.
You know.
As I say, I understand why they did it.
It's a tough sell.
It is a tough sell. And so mm-hmm. to make that choice to draw attention several times in the dialogue to the fact that this happened a couple, you know, 300 years ago. I think that maybe was not the best decision.
So we find out they get to this lab. They find a bunch of papers. They're looking through it. They find out that everybody except for Spock is suffering from this disease because everybody's human except for Spock. And they say, and this is where, you know, Dr. McCoy's space racism happens. And
gets Kirk, in his crack about green blood.
Exactly. Yeah. Kirk is like, why not Spock? And he's like, maybe it just doesn't like green blood. All right, fine.
Does he literally make a reference to Green Blood in every episode? I mean, it feels like it sometimes.
It does feel like it sometimes. And in this situation, I was kind of like, I don't even know if that's appropriate, Dr. McCoy. Maybe, you know, focus on what's happening instead of a cheap shot at Spock. But okay.
Also notice that Miri is not at all freaked out by Spock's presence.
That is true. She just rolls with it.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't even question the fact that there's this weird-looking guy with pointy ears who apparently has green blood. It's not. It doesn't even come up in conversation. Again, is that the point of the story? No. So let's, you know, let's not address it. But it does make you think. Well, hang on. How did this planet get? Are they aware of Vulcans? Were they part of the Federation? What's going on here?
Maybe she's just used to grown-ups being weird-looking, and she's like, okay, whatever. This guy has weird ears. It's fine. So yeah, they are finding a bunch of research, so they're using an old microscope, and there's a weird scene where Spock comments on the microscope, and McCoy yells at him. That's strange. I don't know why they kept that in, but whatever.
I think that's because they just made somebody, I can't remember, it might have been Kirk in a captain's log, actually, had made reference to tempers getting short.
Oh, I thought that was before that, but it doesn't matter.
That's what I mean. The reference is before then, and so then they have to demonstrate it.
Ah, I see what you're saying. I didn't pick up on that. All right, I'll give that to them. Good job, story. And this is where we meet in another section, the kids that we haven't seen that have been taunting people. And this is where we find out, you know, they're dressed in like some cowboy costumes, and one's wearing a creepy mask. And there's Jan, I guess is how you say it, who is like the male guy who's almost an adolescent himself, but not quite. And he's the leader of the pack. And he decides that they're always talking into these little boxes. So let's take the little boxes from them. Why? I don't know, but why not?
Right. Again, like it's if you don't know their radios, then how do you know that they must be important? It's very frustrating. I recognize the actor playing Jan as well, and I can't think for the life of me where I'd seen him before, but I've definitely seen him in probably in like 1980s low budget movies or something, but it absolutely rang. I was like, I know that actor, and I just could not place where I know him from.
He is, I'm looking because I also, he has a very distinctive face.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And he was in Scrooged, which is what I recognize him from. But anyway, yes, he, and I will say he, so there's something a little off with these children, which I think is supposed to be, right? Because they're 300 years old, they're creepy, and he plays that very well. Like that kind of, there's something not quite right about these folks.
There is, and actually, I think if the rest of the kids had been played more like him, where they clearly have some cunning and some mm-hmm. maturity, you know, not enough, but some, I think actually that might have been more creepy. I mean, it would have changed certain scenes, obviously. As I say, again, I understand why they made these decisions, but it would have taken things in a different direction. But just imagine if there had been a dozen kids who were all as sort of wily and cunning as he was, rather than all just sort of blindly following whatever he said. I think that would have been quite interesting.
I think it would be too, but that is not the story they gave us.
No.
I should say before they steal, so they steal the communicators, but before that, they link up with the ship's computers and they figure out they have 7 days before this disease will.
Oh, that's right, the ticking clock.
Yeah, yes. That's important bit. And they'll die within 7 days. So they're on it. And here's my biggest problem with this episode, is they steal the communicators, the kids steal the communicators. And the Enterprise is still in orbit around the planet, but seemingly because the kids stole their communicators, there is like nobody checks in.
They do nothing.
Yeah. They don't like beam down another communicator.
Well, I think at that point, Kirk has already. This happens after Kirk has had a conversation with them and said, "Don't send anybody else down here. It's a death sentence."
Yes.
So you can understand them not sending anybody, but you're absolutely right that they surely still have the coordinates.
Because
we don't see the computer being beamed down, but you assume that it must have been beamed to the lab.
Right.
So yeah, why not beam another communicator down to the same coordinates?
And I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, it doesn't, like, the timing doesn't matter. They give a ticking clock of 7 days, but maybe they'll be, like, out of contact for a couple of hours or something. No, it's like 2 days. And I thought, I really think they would do something within 2 days with a ship. Like their first officer, their captain, and their chief doctor are on this planet. And for 2 days, they don't do anything.
And they're just twiddling their thumbs going, I'm sure it's fine.
That was my biggest problem with this episode. But during those 2 days, though, everybody's freaking out. Well, the people on the planet are freaking out because they want to, you know, they're cut off. They need to tempers. This is where their tempers are flaring. Everybody's arguing. And Captain Kirk convinces Miri to bring them to the kids so that he can, you know, try to get his communicators back.
Oh, and I think before this point, Spock has already said that even though he's not infected, he's a carrier. Not yes. entirely sure how he knows that, considering that there's nobody else on the planet to infect, but, you know, whatever. Again, not important. but the point is that, yeah, he says, well, I'm a carrier, so
I can't go back
either if we don't find this cure, even though I'm not personally infected, which is admirable, I think.
Yes, and that gives one of my favorite Leonard Nimoy readings in this episode when he says, you know, I can't go back to the ship even if I wanted to, and I want to go back to the ship.
Right, yeah, and I do want to. Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, Spock, that I completely understand. Another scene that I did not like in this episode, but we should talk about, is Captain Kirk is talking to Miri, and this is when everybody has, so Yeoman Rand also has the disease, so emotions are higher than they would be, right? And they're all acting erratically. Yeoman Rand sees Captain Kirk talking to Miri. She gets upset and runs out. I think maybe she drops something and she runs out of the lab. Captain Kirk goes after her, and they have a scene where she's basically crying because she doesn't like the fact that he's giving Miri attention. And Yeoman Rand says, I tried to get you to notice my legs on the Enterprise, and now look at them. And I don't know if they actually show us her legs, but we can assume that
they do. There's a small patch of the blue, yes. you know, like blue putty on her thigh. I mean, it really, there's not a lot. All of the sort of disease makeup in this is quite minimal.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably the best choice, given what it looks like.
It is a bizarre scene, though. I mean, if nothing, apart from the sort of ridiculous emotional immaturity of it, there's also the fact that, like, it's impossible to be on the Enterprise and not see all the women's legs. Like,
it is true.
You don't need to go to any special effort.
Yes, those tiny miniskirts do a lot of the work for you, Yeoman
Rand.
Exactly,
yeah.
You don't have to try. And I will say, I mean, Yeoman Rand is I was talking about how the extras in this episode would not be on television probably now. Yeoman Rand and the actress who plays her is a very beautiful woman. So, I mean, it is
she
clear.
Would. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Captain Kirk would notice her. Everybody notices her. I just thought it was a weird scene. And it's of the time, right? But it just was like, ugh.
That's very much one of those where you have to watch it in context and think, okay, well, you know, at the time, this would have been seen as dramatized, but nevertheless relatively normal behavior within a drama. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think anybody ever acted like that in real life,
no.
But within the context of drama of the times, it was quite normal.
Yes. And then Dr. McCoy makes a breakthrough, and he thinks they have a vaccine, but he's not sure if it'll work or not.
Yes. Instead, it might be what my favorite line of the, do you title these episodes? This must be the episode title, A Beaker Full of Death.
Which, you know, I think they're just telling the people at home, this is a treacherous decision, so we shouldn't
do
it lightly.
Well, and it's a complete setup. I mean, the minute he said that, I knew what was going to happen in a couple of scenes' time. It was, you know, why would you emphasize that so much otherwise? But I just love the way it could be a beaker full of death.
Beaker, yes, it's crazy. Another plot point I completely skip over, which is important, is that at one point Miri then decides, okay, I've had enough of these grown-ups. Because they are telling me that I'm going to get the disease, and I don't think that's true. And so she gets upset. So she goes back to the other kids, and they hatch a plan to capture Yeoman Rand. And one of the kids says, well, what if we just take one of them? It's not really going to stop them. And to which she replies, well, Captain Kirk is going to look for Yeoman Rand, so it'll be two of them, which is clever, I think. And so they do. They take Yeoman Rand, Captain Kirk, much to, it's as if Miri can read the script. Captain Kirk decides he needs to save Yeoman Rand. And so he goes and finds her. And this leads to, so a lot of people give William Shatner guff about his overacting, perhaps. But this scene in the classroom with the kids like chanting and hitting him, and he's like, you know, no, listen to me, no, blah, 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 which is ridiculous. And I tweeted an animated GIF, no, blah, blah, blah. it is ridiculous when seen out of context, but in the moment, I think it is actually very effective because it's a creepy scene. He is completely, he's wracked by this disease. He's overwhelmed by these children who are just chanting, no, blah, blah. It's infuriating. And so he's like, cut it out. So I thought it was a very effective scene.
I agree. I couldn't have said that better myself. Yeah, it's within the context of the episode. It's actually a really fine performance. And also considering how many takes they had during that, apparently. One of the things I read was that, because the young baby who is sort of like brought towards him and slaps him is his daughter. I can't remember her name, Isabella or something like that. Forgive me, I can't remember her name. But apparently they had to reshoot that several times because every time she came at him to slap him, it's her daddy and, you know, she's a tiny little girl. And so she was like sort of smiling and, you know, almost going to hug him. And he's like, no, no, you don't understand. So considering how many takes they would have done of that scene for him to maintain that sort of crazed energy and sort of desperate feeling throughout, you know, yeah, I think it speaks to his quality as an actor. He's an idiosyncratic actor, no question. Yes, he has his own style. He's like Sean Connery. Everything Sean Connery is in, he plays Sean Connery. And Shatner's the same. Everything Shatner's in, he plays Shatner. But he plays it very well. And it can be, in the right context and with the right material, it can be very, very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need to know, if you have a William Shatner, you need to know how to use a William Shatner. He is not morph himself to your character.
No. Absolutely not.
And he's at the point, I don't know if at this point in his career he was at that point of his career, but now certainly, like, you, if you get William Shatner, you are getting William Shatner, and you know that.
Yeah, you're not even getting a character, you're just getting William Shatner. Yeah, exactly. No, I think even at that point, though, he was, he was already seen as a leading man.
Right.
When he was cast for Star Trek, I believe. I mean, I know he wasn't, you know, sort of mega star, but he was seen as a, you know, handsome, square-jawed leading man. So that is the kind of character, the kind of actor where, you know, you're number one. You're number one on the call sheet. Right. You are the one who sort of sets the tenor of the show, and you get to basically play that character however you like. Mm-hmm. That's the privilege you get of being the star of a show. And boy, did he.
He certainly did. He played it to the T. And it's always interesting to read about the tensions between him and Leonard Nimoy because, you know, everyone thought, oh, William Shatner, he's handsome, which he is, and he's the leading man. So everyone who's watching is going to be, Kirk is going to be their favorite character. Women are going to, you know, fall for him. And they did, but they also in greater numbers fell for the enigmatic and alien Mr. Spock, which is
the power of Enigma. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Which they were not accounting for, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. And Leonard Nimoy also handsome.
They're so facially different.
Yes. That,
you know, depending on your preferences, if you are the sort of person who finds Leonard Nimoy attractive, you're just not going to find Bill Shatner attractive. You know, they're so facially different that, you know, just purely in terms of physical attraction, I think it would be quite rare for somebody to be physically attracted to both of those men. Personality obviously complicates things, and yes. I'm sure there were many women out there who loved them both equally. But purely in terms of who you're going to stick a picture of on your wall, it's going to be one or the other. It's probably not going to be both of them.
That's true. They have very different aesthetics, if you will. And so, yeah, Captain Kirk is, meanwhile, while Captain Kirk is being pummeled by children and his daughter, Leonard McCoy, is looking at this potential beaker of death, and he thinks, we can't wait for the ship to tell us if this is right or not. So he injects himself.
The most irresponsible doctor ever.
Well, he's going to sacrifice himself to make sure that it's okay. But, you know, I feel
I totally get it. And it's absolutely within character for Bones to do that. You know, I mean, I'm almost surprised that he didn't prescribe them all a bowl of salad to start with. It's within character, no question. But at the same time, you're you're the chief medical doctor responsible for 1,000 crewmen.
Yeah, you would think, I would think, and even this is not great either, but there's another security guard. You could think, hey, security guard, can I try this on you? Because I have, you know, if it doesn't work on me, I have the knowledge to fix it probably, whereas you don't. But
well, I think more to the point, the security guard should have offered himself.
Yes.
You know, in a more lifelike scenario, it would be incumbent upon the guard to literally just go, doctor, inject me, you know, because we can't afford to lose you. It wouldn't be up to the doctor to sort of even have to make the request.
Mm-hmm. But he doesn't, and McCoy shoots himself up with this potential beaker full of death, but it is in fact a beaker full of life, and it works. Yeah.
Yes, of course it does. Yeah.
Yes, Dr. McCoy.
After the false, the false panic of like, oh no, he's
unconscious,
collapsed to the floor. Yeah, yeah.
And then the makeup disappears as a little time lapse thing, very quickly, and he is fine. Hooray!
I've just realized now that you've said that they redid the effects. When I was watching that, I mean, obviously, you know, the makeup is very primitive and everything, but the dissolve. The time lapse, as you say, of it disappearing, I did think, wow, that was really well done for the time. Incredible. But now I know that they
probably
cleaned it up.
Cleaned it up, yes. Because somebody thought, that doesn't look good. Let's clean it up. And Captain Kirk, I skip over, you know, he's bloodied by the kids and he says, look, you're doing what grubs do. Just give me my stuff back and we'll help you. And the kids are like, okay, fine. You've convinced us, Captain Kirk, as you always do. And he saves Yeoman Rand. They come back. Dr. McCoy's fine. They call up to the ship and they're like, we're leaving. Bye, kids.
So long.
And someone says, I think maybe it was Yeoman Rand, says, it doesn't feel right to leave a planet full of children by themselves. And I thought, that's because it isn't right. And then Captain Kirk says, oh, don't worry. We're sending teachers and people will help them. It'll be fine.
Also, they don't know that it's a planet full of children. They've only seen one square mile of the place. You know, they don't know whether those
that
are
is true.
All that remains or whether there are millions of children on that planet. They have no idea.
They don't look. They're just like, we got to go. This planet that is an exact duplicate of Earth holds no interest to us.
No further interest.
That's right. We are done. Let some B team come in and check out the rest. We've got more action on another planet to do next week.
That is kind of crazy. I hadn't really thought about that. But you're right. At the end, it's just like, yeah, whatever, you know, we're moving on. Hang on.
Wait a second. This is like possibly one of the most exciting things you've discovered and you don't care.
You've just discovered some kind of weird parallel Earth. It's very bizarre.
It is very bizarre. So Anthony, this is you've seen this for the first time for this podcast. So what did you think of it as basically like a brand new original series episode for you?
I thought it was good. I thought it was one of the better original series episodes. I'm now angry with the BBC that I never saw it when I was younger. I mean, as you of all people know, quality of the original series episodes fluctuates.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit. But I thought this was one of the stronger ones. Absolutely. You know, not the strongest, but definitely in the sort of, you know, above the halfway mark of quality.
Were the people in Great Britain just terribly sensitive in the 60s? Because it doesn't seem like this episode was all that problematic.
I honestly don't know. I think there's no detail given on this, but I suspect that it was largely because of the children, you know, committing violent acts and attacking adults and that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing that even today actually can still be controversial. You know, I'm an old man, 10-year-old series, but series like Skins and things like that, you know, that show kids doing, you know, taking drugs and being violent and, you know, acting out and all that sort of thing can still be controversial. over here. Possibly, I don't know if that's necessarily not the case in the States, but you can still get people, you know, you can still get the tabloids worked up into a lather by having children do things that aren't supposedly kid-like, you know, that are engaging in adult activities. So I suspect that was it, but I don't think we'll ever really know.
Unless we do more research, and I'm not willing to do more research. No. It's an interesting pop culture footnote.
My interest in researching this further is about the same as the Enterprise's interest in an identical mirror image Earth.
That's right. You've got other things to do. So long.
I'm a busy man.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk about Star Trek with me.
You're welcome, Scott. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on again.
And bonk bonk on the head.